Welcome to another edition of the Bharat Varta Weekly about the Kashmiri Pandit exodus and genocide as well. Of course, India continues to thumb the nose on Western pressure, right? We continue to be sort of neutral on the Russia-Ukraine conflict. We are importing oil from Russia, and that has rubbed a few people the wrong way. And there's plenty of pressure from those quarters to change on that front. The Japanese Prime Minister's visit and his meeting with Prime Minister Modi is also something that happened, and we'll be discussing various aspects of that. And as usual, after every election defeat, the Gandhi family has had offered to resign, and of course their resignations were rejected as expected. There was also the case of the Forex reserves declining to a two-year low. Nirav especially is going to add to that as well and explain why that is the case and so on. So we have plenty to discuss today on the Bharat Varta Weekly. Thank you again for joining us. So let's start with the episode we put out last week, Leading India Through the COVID Crisis. And as I mentioned on the podcast, I think it's very, very important to record contemporary history. We tend to forget a lot of things. Obviously, I mean, a lot of us live, you know, very busy lives, and it's easy to gloss over everything that's happened over the last couple of years, but it's been remarkable by any stretch of the imagination, right? One of the most difficult crises in modern times. Abhishek, did you have a listen to the podcast with PM Gandhi Modi?
Yeah, I partly listened to it, and I think she gave a very thorough and detailed breakdown of how, you know, India was able to combat, or how we first prepared and then were able to combat the COVID crisis. So, for example, she explains the state of medical supplies and PPE kits and all that at the start of the pandemic, and how quickly we ramped up. You know, that was remarkable. You know, and obviously, I think the challenges in terms of state capacity, etc., were well known. So, yeah, I think it's a very good documentation. And as you said, it's like history being recorded contemporaneously, right?
Yeah.
Because we know what happens, as we discuss in the next topic, when history is not documented properly, right?
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Very factual as well. And the other thing about her book, especially, is that it offers a comparison, right? I mean, what is happening in the world, what is happening in a few other countries at that very instant in time. Obviously, you know, when there's a crisis, you know, plenty of bad things are going to happen, but you have to see this in perspective, right? Again, please do check out the book, A Nation to Protect, Leading India Through the COVID Crisis. A fantastic book. And it's a must read for everyone to really understand what happened over the last couple of years. All right. Moving on to the first piece of news for this week. Kashmir Files is approaching 200 crores of collection at the box office. That's a phenomenal number. The movie collected around 60 crores in the first 5 days of the release itself, and it has become a full-fledged movement of sorts towards obtaining belated justice for lakhs of persecuted Kashmiri Pandits. Prime Minister Modi praised the movie as well, claiming that it showed the truth from a right perspective and that vested interests were running a campaign to discredit it. We saw multiple national and international media taking aim at the movie, claiming that it promoted hate against a particular community. There have also been reports of sloganeering in theaters and so on. Well, I'll get to my perspective on this. I watched it a couple of days back, but I would love to hear your views, Abhishek.
Yeah, so I also recently saw it. Like, as you said, it's an unconventional movie because it takes up a topic which is generally taboo for erstwhile, you know, establishment in India, right? Whether it is political or social, right? I mean, it's, to begin with, it's a brave topic to bring up because, you know, people generally want to avoid discussing this ghastly chapter in our history. So, first of all, kudos to Vivek Agnihotri for picking up this topic. I think if you were simply to do an artistic or critical analysis of the movie, you will find, or you can find, a lot of flaws. You can criticize it, etc. But I think that all that discussion right now is besides the point. To a large section of the population of India, this is going to be the first time, at least in a long time, that this topic is being brought up for discussion. For many folks who are relatively younger, who have probably been born in the mid-90s or later, this is probably a chapter that is totally forgotten, right? So no one sort of really mentions it or teaches it in school, colleges, and so on, right? So it's an important topic to be, you know, brought into public discussion. In terms of the movie itself, it's a very tough watch, right? So people prepared to feel the pain of those who suffered really hits you hard. The other thing I'll probably mention is, so I have not seen Vivek Agnihotri's movie, on the one he did on the Maoists and campus.
Buddha and a traffic jam.
Traffic jam, yeah. So I think he did bring up campus politics and all that in that one as well. But irrespective of whatever he did, I mean, I guess that is a topic quite close to his heart and he takes a lot of interest in all that. But the portrayal in this one is also something that is going to hit hard to the common public in India, because they may not be aware of the kind of radicalism that is mainstream in campus politics, right? Which is like a parallel universe itself compared to the regular politics that happens in India in terms of the issues taken or the stands taken by students in these elite national colleges. So I think that portrayal also is going to actually shock some people. And I don't think anyone can really say the portrayal in that was also inaccurate. So, yeah, I think it's a very important movie. Do watch it, but, you know, be prepared to feel the pain as you go watch it. I think, you know, there is a larger debate in terms of the accuracy of numbers, etc., or individual incidents. But I think that all that misses the point. The fact that right now such a movie can be made itself is a big change in India. I think it's best that, you know, people discuss that, and contrary viewpoint movies have always been made on this topic already. So I also saw some social media debate of people doing whataboutry about why this topic, why not that other incident. I mean, the good part is right now that you can make movies on any of those other incidents. So yeah, I think a good welcome change and a good welcome discussion probably brought into the public sphere.
Yeah, let me start with the criticisms first, right? I think the response to a book should be a book and the response to a movie should be a movie, right? I mean, if you don't like something, make something of your own. And really, I mean, that much creative freedom people should have in terms of the subject matter they deal with and how they portray things and so on, as long as they're factual. Or make it very clear that it's fictional. In this case, I think the thing I like about Vivek Agnihotri movies is that they're all thought starters. Whether it is Buddha in a Traffic Jam, which started the conversation about, you know, communist and leftist movement and urban Naxalites and so on and so forth, or Tashkent Files, which really asked the very important question, how did our, you know, second prime minister pass away in very mysterious circumstances, right? Or this movie, which talks about the Kashmir genocide, right? And as Abhishek mentioned, you know, people are talking about these numbers. The official sources indicate around 219, but people say it's in the order of thousands or tens of thousands of people. But really, I mean, that is missing the point. The fact that this happened is the headline, right? I mean, the fact that this happened in independent India and the state was on watch while some of these atrocities happened really, really is something to think about. And the film doesn't pull any punches, right? I mean, it doesn't show like a romantic angle somewhere. It doesn't show, you know, courteous community. It doesn't do any of those things, right? I mean, there's no sort of balancing as such. I mean, I hate to spoil it for anyone, right? I mean, you should go and watch the movie yourself. But the last 10-15 minutes are not a typical climax that you would experience, right? I mean, it is very, very difficult to watch. And, you know, I watched it in a theater and there were gasps from the audience at particular...
There are no feel-good takeaways from this.
Nothing really. It's almost like a documentary in some sense, right? The audience gasped. Really, I mean, the audience gasped. There was, it's a very difficult movie to watch, really. And kudos to some of the acting performances. I think the actor who portrays Sharda, right? I mean, she was phenomenal. Of course, Pallavi Joshi as the leftist professor is amazing. And of course, Anupam Kher is, I think, I certainly choked up at more than a couple of points because of Anupam Kher's acting. So I think as any other movie, I mean, I came back home and I did a bunch of wikiing, right? And the real details are, I realized are 10x gorier than this. You know, thankfully, I mean, they haven't showed the true extent so much of that on screen. I don't know how, if this itself was not palatable, I can't even imagine, you know, how that would have played out. As I said, I mean, earlier, I think it's a great thought starter. It's amazing that we've started understand what happened. And really, I hope that there is justice for the Kashmiri Hindu community. That's all I can say. All right.
Just adding, I haven't seen the movie, not released in Singapore, and probably won't be. So I probably need to visit India. But I'd read the book by Rahul Pandit about A Moon Has Blood Clots. And that was similar. And I felt that news when I was growing up, didn't portray this enough. A little mention was there in Roja, the movie, and I had like some idea, but very vague idea. We knew more about Gulf War going on between Saddam Hussein and the US, and we didn't know about this. Right. So I think it's a very important thing that in these kind of things, contemporary history is portrayed, or the media and all of that kind of portrays the side of the story as well, which is like completely being blanked out. So that's like a heartening thing.
Yeah. And see, whether it is Roja or whether it is Mission Kashmir or whatever, right, there is this sort of a, especially I think filmmakers do this where they say that, you know, there is like, it's a very complex subject. There is shades of gray in everything, but there isn't. Sometimes there isn't. Sometimes things are as black and white as possible. Right. And that is one thing that I get from this movie. I mean, there is no need to sort of balance things out. I mean, they portray it as it is. I was reading, Shekhar Gupta's piece in the print, actually. It reminded me why, you know, Mr. Shekhar Gupta is, has lasted, you know, 3 decades plus in journalism, right? And is so active. I mean, the guy is like really intelligent and hardworking, right? I mean, what is it like 1,000 episodes of Cut the Clutter or something, right? And it does this, I don't know how to put it. I mean, it does this weird monkey balancing by saying, you know, first acknowledging that, yes, I mean, it's important that this film has come out. Yes, it's correct. And then it tries to subtly balance things out with plenty of other things that happened, right? As if, you know, I mean, that this any less.
To be fair to Shekhar Gupta, at least he says, yes, it's correct. Like many people...
but that's a very, that if I reject your, if I reject your premise outright, you will not listen to me. If I accept your premise and deviate it a little bit, I mean, then you will keenly listen to it, right? So which is why, I mean, a lot of people, whether it's the left, right, or center, I mean, they do read Shekhar Gupta, they watch what he has to say and so on, right?
Influence, cannot be denied. And obviously,
absolutely,
as you said, he has the right formula for getting everyone to listen.
exactly, right? So it's amazing, actually. I mean, it's such a brilliant, if you study it, it's so brilliant. I mean, the first paragraph is, yes, right, this happened, the movie has to be made, etc., etc. And then he spends maybe like, you know, three paragraphs down, he tries to add all of these other, you know, monkey balancing, right? So anyway, I mean, it's good that the debate has started. And if you haven't watched the movie, please do watch the movie. I mean, as all of us have said, I mean, it's a bit of a difficult watch, but it's necessary that you understand what happened, right? All right, moving on. Indian Oil has finalized a deal to import crude oil from Russia. The Indian Oil Corporation has signed a deal with Russian oil company to import 3 million barrels of crude. Western companies have imposed sanctions on Russia, but there are no restrictions for Indian companies. As the US and other Western nations slapped sanctions on Moscow, Russia has begun offering oil and other commodities at discounted prices to India and other large importers. A response from the US stated that this action did not violate sanctions, but implied that India was supporting the invasion of Ukraine. Nirav, there's plenty of chatter about this, but...
So few things let me clarify. One is the sanctions on Russia exempt oil and gas. Germany continues to buy natural gas from Russia. US continues to buy uranium from Russia. And also Shell bought one cargo from Trafigura at a 28% discount. So basically what has happened is the sanctions, apart from hitting Russia, insurance companies can't insure like shipping vehicles, container ships, etc. So like a lot of other companies can't deal with them. How do you keep a contract if there's something goes wrong, the cargo is uninsured, etc. Two is India bought about 3 million barrels of oil. India consumes 5 million barrels a day. So this is like 60% of one day's consumption, right? So it's not that big. And finally, India does not have a side in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. India is dependent on energy needs. I don't think India will be able to import a lot of oil from Russia for two reasons. One is that to ship it from Russian oil fields to India, I think the pipelines, etc., where continental shelf Russia is connected to Europe is easier. To get it from Russia to India via long shipping routes is much tougher. And as I mentioned, I think unless like the Russian government insures their ships, those kind of things will be tougher. Two is Indian refineries are all calibrated for their input to be Middle Eastern crude. Most of our crude comes from Iraq, Saudi, UAE, and earlier from Iran as well. So maybe I think Iran sanctions will be lifted soon. So India will start buying oil from Iran. And another thing I want to point out is US has shown how it can like weaponize either the SWIFT payment system, which is a European system, or like the US dollar. So now it's tough to make any US dollar payments to Russia. Or if Russia gets those US dollars, tough for Russia to make any payments. So India probably might be paying rupees to Russia, and this would be kept in a Vostro account where Russia can either buy Indian imports. Maybe it's an opportunity for Indian manufacturers like Mahindras or other, like say either, I don't know, software services or some goods, or somewhere where some trading companies can buy other goods from the West and ship it to Russia. No real idea. So I think that is one thing where you kind of have an alternative. And finally, US understands that India has a unique relationship with Russia. India is dependent on a lot of oil imports. India had a particular situation where we had 20,000 citizens in Ukraine and we wanted their safety to come back. India has more than 20,000, way more than 20,000 in Russia right now, in Moscow and like other St. Petersburg and other cities, right? India has to be bothered about its own citizens. I think we shouldn't give too much publicity to these kind of things. What has happened is, in the West, they've kind of gone either you're with us or against us. And India, till like really hard sanctions were put on Iran, was buying oil from Iran. India probably now will buy oil from Iran in rupees. Again, Iran will either buy food grains or something else via India. So I think, because India needs to remember one more thing as well, that we need a tricky balancing act. All these years, US was a Pakistan ally. And right now, US had put sanctions on Venezuela, but they flipped on a dime because they say, okay, bigger enemy is Russia. So they are removing sanctions from Venezuela. So I think that is also a very big issue, that tomorrow they could flip and again become Pakistan ally. So India has to keep its sovereignty and its own neutrality and its own decisions are in India's interest. Lastly, even if we want to import a lot, we may not be able to, because a lot of the refineries have to be recalibrated depending on your input stock. So refineries are very complex pieces of like very complex factories. Depending on the quality of crude which comes in, you have like different sets of output. It's not just petrol or diesel what we consume. All the petrochemicals, plastics, fertilizers, natural gas, liquefied petroleum gas, finally tar and like shipping fuel, bunker fuel, all that comes in out, right? I don't think companies like Reliance, etc. might want to do it. Maybe it'll be mostly the Indian PSUs. Based on the Shell Trafigura transaction, we can assume that the going rate was about 28% discount to the market price, right? So it's an opportunity. But most probably, if the quality of crude is very different, Indian PSUs might actually blend it a bit, and maybe 10%, 5-10% of whatever feedstock, if we can get it at a 30% discount, why not? Also, it kind of keeps US also on its toes, saying that, okay, if they take very much anti-India stance, India has alternatives as well. And India needs to balance it out. In fact, these things should be done maybe like quietly without too much media attention, because US in particular is a democracy. And if like the very left-leaning people in the US raise a lot of noise about it, maybe Biden will be forced to kind of put some kind of like slap the wrist sanctions on India or Indian companies. We want to avoid it. I think be opportunistic, be nimble, and make the best what is for India. We are not fighting against Russia. We are not fighting for or against Ukraine. I think we need to be neutral and keep these commercial transactions aside. So I think that's what it is. We should make use of the opportunity, but rather be quiet about it. That's all what I can say.
No, I think there were a few protests, most notably, I think, by this guy, Ro Khanna, who's a US representative, right? What do you think, Abhishek? Do you have a look at the quote tweets?
Yeah, so interesting development. So a lot of this think tank crowd who tracks India from the US has been pretty critical of India, right? Including one of our guests on Bharatvarta, right? Bruno, although even Bruno himself has now gone a little softer, probably after coming over to India and attending the Jaipur Lit Fest. Yeah, so I think one interesting development is that over time, with the pushback from India, the audience in India, one thing is that when it comes to foreign policy on Russia, I think there is no partisan divide in India, right? Whether it is the BJP or the part or the opposition, everybody is pretty consistent in their stance towards Russia. And I think that has also meant that people at least went beyond looking at the superficial things that they were saying initially. And so I think yesterday an interesting long piece has come out in Vox, right, which is a pretty big liberal outlet. And I thought the piece is pretty well balanced. Like, they have done their research to explain why, you know, India is not reflexively doing an anti-Russia thing and why India has its interest. Like, they have hit all the key bullet points that we talk about, you know, from arms sale to historical friendship, 1971 and so on, right? So finally, I think they are also making an effort to try to understand India's viewpoint. So I think that's a good development. I think even We'll talk about the Japanese PM's visit. So I think the fears of, you know, India getting sanctioned or whatever you hear from the Twitter space is a little bit overblown. I think at a government level and even at a general level, I think India's viewpoint is now getting better understood generally.
And I think the US reaction also has been sort of reasonable, right? I would
the
say
government
there's nothing
reaction
major.
Has been reasonable. Yeah. It's more the think tank crowd which went berserk initially.
Yeah. And kudos to the government and the dispensation as well, right? Because in the initial days, I think all of us wondered how long we'll be able to hold, right? But they've been fairly strong-willed on that front, right? I'm talking about the Indian government, of course. All right, moving on to some political news. Congress President Sonia Gandhi and her children offered to resign at the latest Congress meeting. Sonia Gandhi presented the resignation offer as the, to quote, ultimate sacrifice in the interest of the party. Reportedly, this proposal was unanimously rejected. Surprise, surprise. When asked, a Congress MLA stated that while a lot of deliberations took place, there will be no murmur against the leadership until organizational elections. In 2019, Rahul Gandhi stepped down as the president of Congress. However, he still continues to call most of the major shots in the functioning of the party. Priyanka Gandhi is general secretary in charge of Uttar Pradesh, where the Congress failed to make any impact in the state elections. Abhishek, so another election, another resignation, and another rejection. It's like lather, rinse, repeat, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now, you know, you can have bought already, you know, program and write exactly what is going to happen in a Congress election cycle. So there'll be initially an excitement around the campaigning by Gandhi siblings. There'll be large crowds apparently who are very excited and they are supposed to do well. Then the results will come and all this will follow, right? They'll offer to resign, that will get rejected. Then the next level folks will be asked to resign. So that's what happened, right? Like all the Pradesh Congress chiefs were asked to resign. So including Navjot Singh Sidhu. So I think all this internal political drama is ongoing within the Congress. So I saw Kapil Sibal had said something like, he wants a sab ki Congress and not a ghar ki Congress. And then he got bashed up pretty badly by the various functionaries of the Congress party, right? So all that is happening. I think there is a infamous G23 group which had been formed. And so basically wanted reforms in the party. So some of those folks have met with the Gandhis recently. So all that was news. I mean, right now, the Congress party is probably a good material for a Amazon Prime or Netflix long-running drama rather than being suited for the Indian political scene. But I think all this will continue. I don't really know what's the next big chapter. It's more sort of a routine repetition, as you said, right? Everything seems to have happened before and it's happening again and again.
I think I just want to add something here, right? So basically, if you remember, like Congress had split. So people call it the grand old party, but actually Congress had split into two factions, Congress I and Congress O. So while they said Congress I stood for India, it is actually stood for Indira, right? And she said Indira is in India and India is Indira. And Congress O were the others. And like that split happened after Lal Bahadur Shastri passed away and somewhere in like late 60s, just before the emergency. You had some of the members at that time in Congress O, some of them came back. One was Sharad Pawar, who became a CM of like the different Congress, and now he's got his Nationalist Congress party. So this is essentially, now it's a family business. See, a family business will shut down if the family is not there. So if they offer to resign, all the other people will protest and say this resignation won't be accepted. Two is, it is not a cadre party. So their coterie are all loyalists who are loyal to this family, and only by being loyal to the family do you get plum posts, not by having like a lot of ground support and clout. If you're like a big satrap regionally, and a lot of those guys have migrated, either they've gone to their own party, they've migrated out. You see like the differences, you see like a YSR Congress, or you see, say for example, Trinamool Congress was formed that way, or like Sharad Pawar moved out. So it's kind of lost all the people who are like working on the ground, and all the whatever remains are the ones who are loyal to the family business. And so I think that is there. What the hope is that because it was the earlier the largest party and now like probably the second largest party in the Lok Sabha at the moment, they believe that any kind of reversal, that a turn in tide as seasons change,
will benefit
should come
them.
Back.
Yeah.
Yes. But what we might see is hollowing out, and we might see like a lot of other regional parties. AAP is one party which has taken the left of center kind of position and like say, formed now governments in two states. There are a lot of regional parties. So that is what it is. I think another piece of stat which has come out earlier has been that if once Congress becomes a third or fourth party in the state, it has never recovered.
Right.
Maybe this kind of goes down. A lot of places it's just two parties, where right now it's BJP or Congress in states like Rajasthan or Madhya Pradesh, Gujarat, or like Chhattisgarh. So I think Rajasthan and Chhattisgarh are the two big states where they have their parties. Similarly, like in Kerala, it's either left or the Congress. So where there's just two parties, they do come back, bounce back. But eventually, once they move to the third position, it's very difficult. And as Abhishek mentioned, right, this is you see like these family oriented dynasties, even in the earlier royal families, right? They come, rise, they have a path, rise, and then they decline until another dynasty comes over, right? And maybe this is what is happening here.
So I was reading some so like prominent former, you would say, Congress supporters, or you know, generally famous names in Indian media have started writing against the Gandhis, right?
What do you make of Ramchandra Guha's suggestion that Ravish Kumar should be the head of Congress?
Yeah, yeah. So that was legendary, right? There are a couple of things. So one is on the dynasty question, they go back and forth, right? So I saw someone, again, I read three or four pieces. I don't remember who said what, but so one of them has suggested that, look, there are X, Y, Z other families who are dynasties and who are doing well. So it's not that dynasty is the problem. Like, I think they put YSR as the example, or they take the example of many other dynasts in, let's say, the BJP. What they kind of every time miss out is that it's not that if you are, let's say, a J.M. Sindhia or whatever, right? Pankaja Munde, that you can't be a leader in BJP. It's that they don't get the top spot by default, right? That's something people tend to miss out in this whole, when they're trying to justify that dynasty is fine, right? No one is being given the top spot by default in the BJP, right? And the other thing is, I think one thing everyone is sort of beginning to acknowledge is the energy and effort that is put in by, you know, people like PM Modi or Amit Shah, etc. And that is something the Gandhis, now, like, no one can really deny, even from those who are sympathetic to their side, that the Gandhi siblings do not quite put in similar kinds of effort in terms of time, right, on the field.
They, no, especially there, in comparison, right?
Yeah, they will be there maybe 2-3 months before the election, and then they will go away, while BJP will start preparing for the next election the day a particular result is announced for another state. So that sort of difference in work ethic is now quite apparent to everyone, right? So that's also another factor at play here.
So we did an episode, I think, in 2020 on the future of the Indian National Congress. I think plenty of things from that.
All that still remains relevant, I feel.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think it was with Bodhi, with Rohit and Ashish.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, we'll link it in the description. Do check out that episode. It's fascinating, actually, how much of that is still relevant right now. Last week, we saw India's forex reserves decline. India's reserves declined by $9.646 billion to $622.275 billion. This sharp decline in the country's foreign currency assets coincides with a week during which the rupee hit an all-time low of 77.02. The RBI intervened to prevent any further slide in the value of the rupee by selling dollars from forex reserves. They are estimated to have sold $1 billion a day during the last week. However, the value of gold reserves rose in line with the sharp appreciation in gold price during the week.
No, so I think this is actually like a very good move by RBI. So if you remember in 2020, where oil prices collapsed, and and India imported or consumed less oil as well, right? So it was like a double whammy. So double benefit that time. So that time what RBI did was they did not let the rupee appreciate. From being a net importer country for a small period of time, like our current account surplus was running. So at that time, when especially Facebook, Google, etc. were investing in Jio, there were a lot of inflows. There were a lot of inflows into Indian equities, a lot of inflows coming into Indian startups. So that time RBI built up a war chest of reserves going from about $450 billion to about 635 or 640 was at the peak. That's towards end of 2021. So what India did, so one was the government also raised fuel taxes, which you can look at it, if you thought of it as a very progressive person in the West, you say, oh, it's a very good carbon tax. This is good for the environment, right? And then what they have done is now when you are starting to see that the US is struggling with inflation, the Federal Reserve hike rates, the Bank of England hike their rates. So a lot of the money which came in slowly moves back, because a lot of this is by people who are leveraged accounts who borrow in the short run to like make risky bets. So now they're pulling back, they're cutting down on risk. India stocks are like a risky asset. So you see these outflows. You see that the oil prices are higher, our import bill rises. So what they have done is, in good times, you've saved money. You built up this war chest of reserves, which you use in the bad times to smoothen out volatility, right? So I think this is a very smart move by RBI. What they will do is they will let the rupee depreciate very gradually. They won't let a sharp depreciation happen. If it appreciates very sharply, they'll control it on the other side as well. And this is very smart management. I think it's a very good thing we do not have like Western academics who believe too much in the free markets, because India is still a developing country. It's still fragile. This kind of stability which it provides, it's like a buffer. If we want to be Atmanirbhar, if we want to have these PLI schemes take off and succeed, we need to do what all the East Asian countries have done. So this is exactly, if we had to learn something from like South Korea or Taiwan, or even China, what happened after the Asian financial crisis, they have done exactly the same. So yeah. I think it's a very sensible thing. So yes, the US dollar or euro reserves have gone down by 11 odd billion dollars, and our gold reserves are revalued higher by $2 billion. So like, it's about 9.646 billion, which has come off, but it's no need to panic. I think we were fine when our reserves were 450 as well. At like 620, we are way better. To put some numbers in perspective, India has imports of about 55 billion a month, and India exports about 30 odd billion a month, right? So about 20 to 20 billion is our net deficit. This is on trade, and we export services like software companies, and we get some equity inflows. So on the balance, we are all fine. I think this is just hot money which is flowing out with all this worries on Russia. Chinese stocks totally tanked last week till they saw some support locally as well. So you've seen a lot of de-risking. So some money is flown out, and RBI has just leaned into it. So it's not a cause of panic. In fact, it was the foresight of RBI to build up these reserves earlier so that they can sell the reserves and stem the depreciation, right? Make it slower, if any, in like periods of panic and stress. So I think it's a very smart management by RBI, if anything.
Moving on to some geopolitics now. The Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida visited India. Kishida-san was sworn in as the Prime Minister of Japan in October last year, with this meeting marking his first visit to India as head of state. He has met Prime Minister Modi four times as Japan's foreign minister earlier. The bilateral talk consisted of topics such as free, open and inclusive Indo-Pacific, progress in defense and security, a reciprocal provision of supplies and service agreement, and more. This year also marks the 70th anniversary of the establishment of India-Japan diplomatic relations. The two countries have achieved the target of 3.5 trillion Japanese yen in public and private investments in India. Abhishek, what are the significant, what is significant about this meeting?
Yeah, firstly, I think the timing is significant that this meeting is happening while the Russia-Ukraine conflict is ongoing. And I believe that was discussed in detail yesterday. I did see some folks stressing the fact that even on Indian soil, the Japanese PM strongly condemned Russia. So they have obviously a very different outlook on the affair, including, you know, the background of them being a key US ally obviously comes into it. But nevertheless, I think PM Kishida's first bilateral trip as a prime minister, obviously India-Japan relationship remain very important and very strong. Like you gave the 3.5 trillion Japanese yen in terms of the target that has been achieved for public and private investment. So a new sort of plan for 5 trillion yen, that is about $42 billion of investment by Japan into India over the next 5 years, is now the new sort of target, right? And they have also sort of talked about a 300 billion yen loan to India. So obviously Japanese investments into India will continue. I think over 1400 Japanese companies have some sort of presence in India. So already, you know, Japan is a big economic, industrial, trade partner for India. and all that will continue. India and Japan are part of the Quad. That relationship via Quad also continues to be important, right? Because one sort of concern for India is that if the US gets too involved into Europe geopolitically, then the focus on the Indo-Pacific and specifically China might go away, right? So that's a concern. And so the India and Japan have to sort of ensure that Indo-Pacific remains a key, you know, focal point in all these cross-country or bilateral cooperations that take place.
I think I saw Ashish's tweet as well that 7 JICA loans have been signed, right? So that includes the Chennai Metro, TN Biodiversity Project, Assam Health, Medical Education, Uttarakhand Horticulture, Bangalore Water Supply, Henny Road, DFC, and so on. We have a question from chat. Veeraj says, how different are Japanese investments in India compared to investments from other countries? You guys want to take this?
So I think one thing I would say is Japanese investments, right? JICA, so JICA, it is very friendly. So if I want to compare that to like a lot of the other investments, say in India, have been, so one has been very private sector focused. So where you have like Samsung or LG putting up plants in India, or like Foxconn, they've put in, right? So that's like private sector. What JICA has done is they've kind of financed things like the bullet train or like these metro projects, etc. And they've had created JVs with creating capacity on the ground in India, right? So this is like kind of government backed, closest, but I would say not a good parallel. So you can look at it in a very, one way was like how the US Marshall Plan was there with its allies, or in a different sense, what China is trying to do with Belt and Road Initiative. But what is the difference is that in Belt and Road Initiative, they kind of, it's the term seem to be a bit of usurious, and then they kind of seize the asset later on if you default. JICA is like a very friendly thing. See, for Japan's geopolitical interests, they need a stronger India, right? And India and Japan have been friends through thick and thin since, I would say, the seeds were sown when like the Maruti investment happened, and through cycles, through different political parties, both on Indian side and on the Japanese side, you had the first wave where Honda Motor set up a JV with Hero Honda, and now they're like a separate company. You had like Suzuki and Maruti, etc. Like all of those came in. You had like one of the first earlier free trade agreements. And two is, you should think about it as a very complementary societies. So Japan is a rich country, a very high saving base, very low interest rates. It has surplus capital and lacks a lot of labor. It is very technologically advanced, at least on the hardware side. Now look at India, exactly opposite. It's a younger country, high cost of capital, much better on the software side, but weaker on the hardware and the hard infra side, right? So I think very complementary societies, where Japan has cheaper cost of capital. We should kind of leverage that, helps us to create infra, which hopefully kickstarts and puts us on a higher slope on growth. So I think it's a very complementary relationship for both countries, as well as you look at from like the allies in the Quad, there's going to be a 2+2 where the foreign minister plus the defense minister will meet each other. So I think on global trade, etc. So it's very much important. So like, as India has to have its independent foreign policy, so while Japan being a US ally, Japan can't even have like a very big army or navy after the World War II kind of sanctions or what was put on it. India has to be independent. While he did mention Russia, India has to be quiet, do what is good for India. So yes, if you could buy Russian crude cheaper, be quiet about it, take some. You want Japan as an ally, take financing. And so these terms are usually like very low interest rate loans. And the Japanese companies also get some of the contracts, but they've developed capacity in India. They've trained up people in India. I would say, like, unlike Belt and Road Initiative, where all the contracts go to, say, Chinese companies, and then Chinese workers get shipped in, Japan itself has a shortage of labor, right? So, in fact, you have, like, senior managers come in, but they train the whole next line. So, yeah, I think it's very, very complementary.
Technological know-how that comes from Japan is something of very deep importance, right?
Absolutely. So I think it's very complementary.
It's a very symbiotic, as you mentioned, very complementary as well, right? I mean, they are extremely good at hardware, we're good at software. And so, which is also why, I mean, you're seeing a lot of interest from the Japanese VCs and even the larger conglomerates, right? I mean, all of them have innovation arms and startup and do startup investments as well. So yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Another one thing I want to point out. What has happened is recently, specifically with what was done with Alibaba and Jack Ma, and SoftBank is the biggest one, which is Japanese VC, but a lot of the pension funds, all their saving funds, a lot of them were invested in Chinese stocks and Chinese kind of venture capital investments. Now, what has happened is that they have kind of been, you know, once bitten, twice shy. They've kind of pulled out from there. So I think when you see like your prime minister visiting, etc., India should seize the moment there as well and try and get private sector funding as well. And China is 5x India's GDP. So even if that money out of diversification comes to India, it can have a much bigger impact. So I think that's very important, these visits. I think PM Modi has been friends with Abe, has been friends with Suga, and now with Kishida as well, right? So while they're all from the same party, I think that maintains that continuity that India and Japan have a good relationship across, like it's a national friendship. It goes across political parties, goes across like
separate. I think there is a mutual respect.
Yes.
Which is pretty rare in terms of how both people of both countries perceive each other, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All right. That brings us to the end of the Bharat Vartha Weekly today. Thank you so much for joining us, folks, and look forward to seeing you again next week. Do stay safe. Take care. And from Nirav, Abhishek and myself, thank you again. Chalo. See you. Bye.
Bye.